Chapter 9. The Community of Worlds. 1. Busy Utopias. There came a time when our newfound communal mind attained such a degree of lucidity that it was able to maintain contact even with worlds that had passed far beyond the mentality of terrestrial man. Of these lofty experiences, I, who am once more reduced to the state of a mere individual human being, have only the most confused memory. I'm like one who, in the last extremity of mental fatigue, tries to recapture the more penetrating intuitions that he achieved in his lost freshness. He can recover only faint echoes and a vague glamour. But even the most fragmentary recollections of the cosmical experiences which befell me in that lucid state deserve recording. The sequence of events in a successfully waking world was generally more or less as follows. The starting point, it will be remembered, was a plight like that in which our own Earth now stands. The dialectic of the world's history had confronted the race with a problem with which the traditional mentality could never cope. The world situation had grown too complex for lowly intelligences, and it demanded a degree of individual integrity in leaders and in led, such as was as yet possible only to a few minds. Consciousness had already been violently awakened out of the primitive trance into a state of excruciating individualism, of poignant but pitifully restricted self-awareness. And individualism, together with the traditional tribal spirit, now threatened to wreck the world. Only after a long-drawn agony of economic distress and maniac warfare, haunted by an increasingly clear vision of a happier world, could the second stage of waking be achieved? In most cases, it was not achieved. Human nature, or its equivalent in the many worlds, could not change itself, and the environment could not remake it. But in a few worlds, the spirit reacted to its desperate plight with a miracle, or, if the reader prefers, the environment miraculously refashioned the spirit. There occurred a widespread and almost sudden waking into a new lucidity of consciousness and a new integrity of will. To call this change miraculous is only to recognize that it could not have been scientifically predicted, even from the fullest possible knowledge of human nature, as manifested in the earlier age. To later generations, however, it appeared as no miracle, but as a belated wakening from an almost miraculous stupor into plain sanity. This unprecedented access of sanity took at first the form of a widespread passion for a new social order which should be just and should embrace the whole planet. Such a social fervor was not, of course, entirely new. A small minority had long ago conceived it and had haltingly tried to devote themselves to it. But now, at last, through the scourge of circumstance and the potency of the spirit itself, this social will became general. And while it was still passionate, and heroic action was still possible to the precariously awakened beings, the whole social structure of the world was reorganized, so that within a generation or two, every individual on the planet could count upon the means of life, and the opportunity to exercise his powers fully, for his own delight, and for the service of the world community. It was now possible to bring up the new generations to a sense that the world order was no alien tyranny, but an expression of the general will, and that they had indeed been born into a noble heritage, a thing for which it was good to live and suffer and die. To readers of this book, such a change may well seem miraculous, and such a state utopian. Those of us who had come from less fortunate planets found it at once a heartening and yet a bitter experience to watch world after world successfully emerge from a plight which seemed inescapable, to see a world population of frustrated and hate-poisoned creatures give place to one in which every individual was generously and shrewdly nurtured, and therefore not warped by unconscious envy and hate. Very soon, though no change had occurred in the biological stock, the new social environment produced a world population which might well have seemed to belong to a new species. In physique, in intelligence, in mental independence and social responsibility, The new individual far outstripped the old, as also in mental wholesomeness and in integrity of will. And though it was sometimes feared that the removal of all sources of grave mental conflict might deprive the mind of all stimulus to creative work and produce a mediocre population, it was soon found that far from stagnating, the spirit of the race now passed on to discover new fields of struggle and triumph. The world population of aristocrats, which flourished after the Great Change, looked back with curiosity and incredulity into the preceding age, and found great difficulty in conceiving the tangled, disreputable, and mostly unwitting motives which were the mainsprings of action even in the most fortunate individuals among their ancestors. It was recognized that the whole pre-revolutionary population was afflicted with serious mental diseases, with endemic plagues of delusion and obsession due to mental malnutrition and poisoning. As psychological insight advanced, the same kind of interest was aroused by the old psychology, as is wakened in modern Europeans by ancient maps, which distort the countries of the world almost beyond recognition. We were inclined to think of the psychological crisis of the waking worlds as being the difficult passage from adolescence to maturity. For in essence, it was an outgrowing of juvenile interests, a discarding of toys and childish games, and a discovery of the interests of adult life. Tribal prestige, individual dominance, military glory, industrial triumphs lost their obsessive glamour. And instead, the happy creatures delighted in civilized social intercourse, in cultural activities, and in the common enterprise of world-building. During the phase of history which followed the actual surmounting of the spiritual crisis in a waking world, the attention of the race was of course still chiefly occupied with social reconstruction. Many heroic tasks had to be undertaken. There was need not only for a new economic system, but for new systems of political organization, of world law, of education. In many cases, this period of reconstruction, under the guidance of the new mentality, was itself a time of serious conflict. For even beings who are sincerely in accord about the goal of social activity may disagree violently about the way. But such conflicts as arose, though heated, were of a very different kind from the earlier conflicts, which were inspired by obsessive individualism and obsessive group hatreds. We noted that the new world orders were very diverse. This was, of course, to be expected, since biologically, psychologically, culturally, these worlds were very different. The perfected world order of an echinoderm race had, of course, to be different from that of the symbiotic ichthyoids and arachnoids, and this from that of a nautiloid world, and so on. And we noted also in these victorious worlds a remarkable identity. For instance, in the loosest possible sense, all were communistic, for in all of them the means of production were communally owned, and no individual could control the labor of others for private profit. Again, in a sense, all these world orders were democratic, since the final sanction of policy was world opinion. But in many cases, there was no democratic machinery, no legal channel for the expression of world opinion. Instead, a highly specialized bureaucracy, or even a world dictator, might carry out the business of organizing the world's activity with legally absolute power, but under constant supervision by popular will expressed through the radio. We were amazed to find that in a truly awakened world, even a dictatorship could be in essence democratic. We observed with incredulity situations in which the absolute world government, faced with some exceptionally momentous and doubtful matter of policy, had made urgent appeals for a formal democratic decision, only to receive from all regions the reply, "We cannot advise. You must decide as your professional experience suggests. We will abide by your decision." Law in these worlds was based on a very remarkable kind of sanction, which could not conceivably work successfully on Earth. There was never any attempt to enforce the law by violence, save against dangerous lunatics, such as sometimes occurred as throwbacks to an earlier age. In some worlds, there was a complex body of laws regulating the economic and social life of groups, and even the private affairs of individuals. It seemed to us at first that freedom had vanished from such worlds. But later we discovered that the whole intricate system was regarded as we should regard the rules of a game, or the canons of an art, or the innumerable extra-legal customs of any long-established society. In the main, everyone kept the law because he had faith in its social value, as a guide to conduct. But if ever the law seemed inadequate, he would without hesitation break it. His conduct might cause offence, or inconvenience, or even serious hardship to his neighbours. They would probably protest vigorously, but there was never question of compulsion. If those concerned failed to persuade him that this behaviour was socially harmful, his case might be tried by a sort of court of arbitration, backed by the prestige of the world government. If the decision went against the defendant, and yet he persisted in his illegal behaviour, none would restrain him. But such was the power of public censure and social ostracism that disregard of the court's decision was very rare. The terrible sense of isolation acted on the lawbreaker like an ordeal by fire. If his motive was at bottom base, he would sooner or later collapse. But if his case had merely been misjudged, or if his conduct sprang from an intuition of value beyond the range of his fellows, he might persist in his course till he had won over the public. I mention these social curiosities only to give some illustration of the far-reaching difference between the spirit of these utopian worlds and the spirit which is familiar to readers of this book. It may be easily imagined that in our wanderings we came upon a wonderful diversity of customs and institutions. But I must not pause to describe even the most remarkable of them. I must be content to outline the activities of the typical waking worlds, so as to be able to press on to tell a story not merely of particular worlds, but of our galaxy as a whole. When a waking world had passed through the phase of radical social reconstruction and had attained a new equilibrium, it would settle into a period of steady economic and cultural advancement. Mechanism, formerly a tyrant over body and mind, but now a faithful servant, would secure for every individual a fullness and diversity of life far beyond anything known on Earth. Radio communication and rocket travel would afford to each mind intimate knowledge of every people. Labour-saving machinery would reduce the work of maintaining civilization. All mind-crippling drudgery would vanish, and the best energy of every one of the world's citizens would be freely devoted to social service that was not unworthy of a well-grown, intelligent being. And social service was apt to be interpreted very broadly. It seemed to permit many lives to be given over wholly to freakish and irresponsible self-expression. The community could well afford a vast amount of such wastage for the sake of the few invaluable jewels of originality which occasionally emerged from it. This stable and prosperous phase of the waking worlds, which we came to call the utopian phase, was probably the happiest of all the ages in the life of any world. Tragedy of one sort or another there would still be, but never widespread and futile distress. We remarked, moreover, that whereas in former ages tragedy had been commonly thought of in terms of physical pain and premature death, now it was conceived more readily as resulting from the clash and mutual yearning and mutual incompatibility of diverse personalities. So rare had the cruder kind of disaster become, and on the other hand so much more subtle and sensitive were the contacts between persons. Widespread physical tragedy, the suffering and annihilation of whole populations, such as we experience in war and plague, were quite unknown, save in those rare cases when a whole race was destroyed by astronomical accident, whether through loss of atmosphere, or the bursting of its planet, or the plunging of its solar system into some tract of gas or dust. In this happy phase, then, which might last for a few centuries, or for many thousands of years, the whole energy of the world would be devoted to perfecting the world community, and raising the caliber of the race by cultural and by eugenical means. Of the eugenical enterprise of these worlds, I shall report little, because much of it would be unintelligible without a minute knowledge of the biological and biochemical nature of each of these non-human world populations. It is enough to say that the first task of the eugenists was to prevent the perpetuation of inheritable disease and malformation of body and mind. In days before the great psychological change, even this modest work had often led to serious abuses. Governments would attempt to breed out all those characters, such as independence of mind, which were distasteful to governments. Ignorant enthusiasts would advocate ruthless and misguided interference in the choice of mates. But in the more enlightened age, these dangers were recognized and avoided. Even so, the eugenical venture did often lead to disaster. One splendid race of intelligent avians we saw reduced to the subhuman level by an attempt to extirpate susceptibility to a virulent mental disease. The liability to this disease happened to be genetically linked in an indirect manner with the possibility of normal brain development in the fifth generation. Of positive eugenical enterprises, I need only mention improvements of sensory range and acuity, chiefly in sight and touch, the invention of new senses, improvements in memory, in general intelligence, in temporal discrimination. These races came to distinguish ever more minute periods of duration, and at the same time to extend their temporal grasp so as to apprehend even longer periods as now. Many of the worlds at first devoted much energy to this kind of eugenical work, but later decided that though it might afford them some new richness of experience, it must be postponed for the sake of more important matters. For instance, with the increasing complexity of life, it soon appeared very necessary to retard the maturing of the individual mind, so as to enable it to assimilate its early experience more thoroughly. Before life begins, it was said, there should be a lifetime of childhood. At the same time, efforts were made to prolong maturity to 3 or 4 times its normal extent, and to reduce senility. In every world that had gained full eugenical power, there arose sooner or later a sharp public discussion as to the most suitable length of individual life. All were agreed that life must be prolonged, but while one party wished to multiply it only 3 or 4 times, another insisted that nothing less than 100 times the normal lifespan could afford the race that continuity and depth of experience which all saw to be desirable. Another party even advocated deathlessness and a permanent race of never-aging immortals. It was argued that the obvious danger of mental rigidity and the cessation of all advancement might be avoided by contriving that the permanent physiological state of the deathless population should be one of very early maturity. Different worlds found different solutions for this problem. Some races assigned to the individual a period no longer than 300 of our years. Others allowed him 50,000. One race of echinoderms decided on potential immortality, but endowed themselves with an ingenious psychological mechanism by which, if the ancient began to lose touch with changing conditions, he could not fail to recognize the fact, and would thereupon crave and practice euthanasia, gladly yielding his place to a successor of more modern type. Many other triumphs of eugenical experiment we observed up and down the worlds. The general level of individual intelligence was, of course, raised far beyond the range of Homo sapiens. But also, that superintelligence which can be attained only by a psychically unified community was greatly developed on the highest practicable plane, that of the conscious individuality of a whole world. This, of course, was impossible till the social cohesion of individuals within the world community had become as close-knit as the integration of the elements of a nervous system. It demanded also a very great advance of telepathy. Further, it was not possible till the great majority of individuals had reached a breadth of knowledge unknown on Earth. The last and most difficult power to be attained by these worlds in the course of their utopian phase was psychical freedom of time and space, the limited power to observe directly, and even contribute to events remote from the spatio-temporal location of the observer. Throughout our exploration, we had been greatly perplexed by the fact that we, most of whom were beings of a very humble order, should have been able to achieve this freedom, which, as we now discovered, these highly developed worlds found so difficult to master. The explanation was now given us. No such venture as ours could have been undertaken by our unaided selves. Throughout our exploration, we had unwittingly been under the influence of a system of worlds which had attained this freedom only after eons of research. Not one step could we have taken without the constant support of those brilliant ichthyoid and arachnoid symbiotics who played a leading part in the history of our galaxy. They it was who controlled our whole adventure, so that we might report our experiences in our primitive native worlds. The freedom of space and time, the power of cosmical exploration, and of influence by means of telepathic contact, was at once the most potent and the most dangerous asset of the fully awakened utopian worlds. Through the unwise exercise of it, many a glorious and single-minded race came to disaster. Sometimes the adventuring world mind failed to maintain its sanity in face of the welter of misery and despair that now flooded in upon it telepathically from all the regions of the galaxy. Sometimes the sheer difficulty of comprehending the subtleties that were revealed to it flung it into a mental breakdown from which there was no recovery. Sometimes it became so enthralled by its telepathic adventures that it lost touch with its own life upon its native planet, so that the world community, deprived of its guiding communal mind, fell into disorder and decay, and the exploring mind itself died. 2. Intermundane strife. Of the busy utopias which I have been describing, a few were already established even before the birth of the other Earth. A larger number flourished before our own planet was formed, but many of the most important of these worlds are temporally located in an age far future to us, an age long after the destruction of the final human race. Casualties among these awakened worlds are, of course, much less common than among more lowly and less competent worlds. Consequently, though fatal accidents occurred in every epoch, the number of awakened worlds in our galaxy steadily increased as time advanced. The actual births of planets, due to the chance encounters of mature but not aged stars, reached, or will reach, a maximum fairly late in the history of our galaxy, and then declined. But since the fluctuating progress of a world from bare animality to spiritual maturity takes on the average several thousands of millions of years, the maximum population of utopian and fully awakened worlds occurred very late, when physically the galaxy was already somewhat past its prime. Further, though even in early epochs, the few awakened worlds did sometimes succeed in making contact with one another, either by interstellar travel or by telepathy, it was not till a fairly late stage of galactic history that intermundane relations came to occupy the main attention of the awakened worlds. Throughout the progress of a waking world, there was one grave, subtle, and easily overlooked danger. Interest might be fixated upon some current plane of endeavor so that no further advance could occur. It may seem strange that beings whose psychological knowledge so far surpassed the attainment of man should have been trapped in this manner. Apparently, at every stage of mental development, save the highest of all, the mind's growing point is tender and easily misdirected. However this may be, it is a fact that a few rather highly developed worlds, even with communal mentality, were disastrously perverted in a strange manner, which I find very difficult to understand. I can only suggest that in them, seemingly, the hunger for true community and true mental lucidity itself became obsessive and perverse, so that the behavior of these exalted perverts might deteriorate into something very like tribalism and religious fanaticism. the disease would soon lead to the stifling of all elements which seemed recalcitrant to the generally accepted culture of the world society. When such worlds mastered interstellar travel, they might conceive a fanatical desire to impose their own culture throughout the galaxy. Sometimes their zeal became so violent that they were actually driven to wage ruthless religious wars on all who resisted them. Obsessions derived from one stage or another of the progress towards utopia and lucid consciousness, even if they did not bring violent disaster, might at any stage sidetrack the waking world into futility. Superhuman intelligence, courage, and constancy on the part of the devoted individuals might be consecrated to misguided and unworthy world purposes. Thus it was that in extreme cases, even a world that remained socially utopian and mentally a super-individual might pass beyond the bounds of sanity. With a gloriously healthy body and an insane mind, it might do terrible harm to its neighbours. Such tragedy did not become possible till after interplanetary and interstellar travel had been well established. Long ago, in an early phase of the galaxy, the number of planetary systems had been very small, and only half a dozen worlds had attained utopia. These were scattered up and down the galaxy at immense distances from one another. Each lived its life in almost complete isolation, relieved only by precarious telepathic intercourse with its peers. In a somewhat later but still early period, when these eldest children of the galaxy had perfected their society and their biological nature, and were on the threshold of super-individuality, they turned their attention to interplanetary travel. First one, and then another, achieved rocket flight in space, and succeeded in breeding specialized populations for the colonization of neighboring planets. In a still later epoch, the middle period of galactic history, there were many more planetary systems than in the earlier ages, and an increasing number of intelligent worlds were successfully emerging from the great psychological crisis which so many worlds never surmount. Meanwhile, some of the elder generation of awakened worlds were already facing the immensely difficult problems of travel on the interstellar and not merely the interplanetary scale. This new power inevitably changed the whole character of galactic history. Hitherto, in spite of tentative telepathic exploration on the part of the most awakened worlds, the life of the galaxy had been in the main the life of a number of isolated worlds, which took no effect upon one another. With the advent of interstellar travel, the many distinct themes of the world biographies gradually became merged in an all-embracing drama. Travel within a planetary system was at first carried out by rocket vessels propelled by normal fuels. In all the early ventures, one great difficulty had been the danger of collision with meteors. Even the most efficient vessel, most skillfully navigated and travelling in regions that were relatively free from these invisible and lethal missiles, might at any moment crash and fuse. The trouble was not overcome till means had been found to unlock the treasure of subatomic energy. It was then possible to protect the ship by means of a far-flung envelope of power, which either diverted or exploded the meteors at a distance. A rather similar method was with great difficulty devised to protect the spaceships and their crews from the constant and murderous hail of cosmic radiation. Interstellar, as opposed to interplanetary travel, was quite impossible until the advent of subatomic power. Fortunately, this source of power was seldom gained until late in a world's development, when mentality was mature enough to wield this most dangerous of all physical instruments without inevitable disaster. Disasters, however, did occur. Several worlds were accidentally blown to pieces. In others, civilization was temporarily destroyed. Sooner or later, however, most of the minded worlds tamed this formidable djinn and set it to work upon a titanic scale, not only in industry, but in such great enterprises as the alteration of planetary orbits for the improvement of climate. This dangerous and delicate process was effected by firing a gigantic subatomic rocket apparatus at such times and places that the recoil would gradually accumulate to divert the planet's course in the desired direction. Actual interstellar voyaging was first effected by detaching a planet from its natural orbit by a series of well-timed and well-placed rocket impulsions, and thus projecting it into outer space at a speed far greater than the normal planetary and stellar speeds. Something more than this was necessary, since life on a sunless planet would have been impossible. For short interstellar voyages, the difficulty was sometimes overcome by the generation of subatomic energy from the planet's own substance. But for longer voyages, lasting for many thousands of years, the only method was to form a small artificial sun and project it into space as a blazing satellite of the living world. For this purpose, an uninhabited planet would be brought into proximity with the home planet to form a binary system. A mechanism would then be contrived for the controlled disintegration of the atoms of the lifeless planet to provide a constant source of light and heat. The two bodies, revolving round one another, would be launched among the stars. This delicate operation may well seem impossible. Had I space to describe the age-long experiments and world-wrecking accidents which preceded its achievement, perhaps the reader's incredulity would vanish. But I must dismiss in a few sentences whole protracted epics of scientific adventure and personal courage. Suffice it that, before the process was perfected, many a populous world was either cast adrift to freeze in space, or was roasted by its own artificial sun. The stars are so remote from one another that we measure their distances in light years. Had the voyaging worlds travelled only at speeds comparable with those of the stars themselves, even the shortest of interstellar voyages would have lasted for many millions of years. But since interstellar space offers almost no resistance to a travelling body, and therefore momentum is not lost, it was possible for the voyaging world, by prolonging the original rocket impulsion for many years, to increase its speed far beyond that of the fastest star. Indeed, though even the early voyages by heavy natural planets were by our standards spectacular, I shall have to tell at a later stage of voyages by small artificial planets travelling at almost half the speed of light. Owing to certain relativity effects, it was impossible to accelerate beyond this point. But even such a rate of travel made voyages to the nearer stars well worth undertaking, if any other planetary system happened to lie within this range. It must be remembered that a fully awakened world had no need to think in terms of such short periods as a human lifetime. Though its individuals might die, the minded world was in a very important sense immortal. It was accustomed to lay its plans to cover periods of many million years. In early epochs of the galaxy, expeditions from star to star were difficult and rarely successful. But at a later stage, when there were already many thousands of worlds inhabited by intelligent races, and hundreds that had passed the utopian stage, a very serious situation arose. Interstellar travel was by now extremely efficient. Immense exploration vessels, many miles in diameter, were constructed out in space from artificial materials of extreme rigidity and lightness. These could be projected by rocket action, and with cumulative acceleration, till their speed was almost half the speed of light. Even so, the journey from end to end of the galaxy could not be completed under 200,000 years. However, there was no reason to undertake so long a voyage. Few voyages in search of suitable systems lasted for more than a tenth of that time. Many were much shorter. Races that had attained and secured a communal consciousness would not hesitate to send out a number of such expeditions. Ultimately, they might project their planet itself across the ocean of space to settle in some remote system recommended by the pioneers. The problem of interstellar travel was so enthralling that it sometimes became an obsession, even to a fairly well-developed utopian world. This could only occur if in the constitution of that world there was something unwholesome, some secret and unfulfilled hunger impelling the beings. The race might then become travel mad. Its social organization would be refashioned, and directed with Spartan strictness to the new communal undertaking. All its members, hypnotized by the common obsession, would gradually forget the life of intense personal intercourse and of creative mental activity which had hitherto been their chief concern. The whole venture of the spirit, exploring the universe and its own nature with critical intelligence and delicate sensibility, would gradually come to a standstill. The deepest roots of emotion and will, which in the fully sane, awakened world were securely within the range of introspection, would become increasingly obscured. Less and less in such a world could the unhappy communal mind understand itself. More and more it pursued its phantom goal. Any attempt to explore the galaxy telepathically was now abandoned. The passion of physical exploration assumed the guise of a religion. The communal mind persuaded itself that it must at all costs spread the gospel of its own culture throughout the galaxy. Though culture itself was vanishing, the vague idea of culture was cherished as a justification of world policy. Here I must check myself, lest I gave a false impression. It is necessary to distinguish sharply between the mad worlds of comparatively low mental development and those of almost the highest order. The humbler kinds might become crudely obsessed by sheer mastery or sheer travel, with its scope for courage and discipline. More tragic was the case of those few, very much more awakened worlds, whose obsession was seemingly for community itself and mental lucidity itself, and the propagation of the kind of community and the special mode of lucidity most admired by themselves. For them, travel was but the means to cultural and religious empire. I have spoken as though I were confident that these formidable worlds were indeed mad, aberrant from the line of mental and spiritual growth. But their tragedy lay in the fact that, though to their opponents they seemed to be either mad or at heart wicked, to themselves they appeared superbly sane, practical, and virtuous. There were times when we ourselves, the bewildered explorers, were almost persuaded that this was the truth. Our intimate contact with them was such as to give us insight, so to speak, into the inner sanity of their insanity, or the core of rightness in their wickedness. This insanity or wickedness I have to describe in terms of simple human craziness and vice, but in truth, it was in a sense superhuman, for it included the perversion of faculties above the range of human sanity and virtue. When one of these mad worlds encountered a sane world, it would sincerely express the most reasonable and kindly intentions. It desired only cultural intercourse and perhaps economic cooperation. Little by little, it would earn the respect of the other for its sympathy, its splendid social order, and its dynamic purpose. Each world would regard the other as a noble, though perhaps an alien and partly incomprehensible, instrument of the spirit. But little by little, the normal world would begin to realize that in the culture of the mad world, there were certain subtle and far-reaching intuitions that appeared utterly false, ruthless, aggressive, and hostile to the spirit, and were the dominant motives of its foreign relations. The mad world, meanwhile, would regretfully come to the conclusion that the other was after all gravely lacking in sensibility, that it was obtuse to the very highest values and most heroic virtues, in fact that its whole life was subtly corrupt, and must for its own sake be changed, or else destroyed. Thus each world, though with lingering respect and affection, would sadly condemn the other. But the mad world would not be content to leave matters thus. It would at length, with holy fervour, attack, striving to destroy the other's pernicious culture, and even exterminate its population. It is easy for me now, after the event, after the final spiritual downfall of these mad worlds, to condemn them as perverts, but in the early stages of their drama, we were often desperately at a loss to decide on which side sanity lay. Several of the mad worlds succumbed to their own foolhardiness in navigation. Others, under the strain of age-long research, fell into social neurosis and civil strife. A few, however, succeeded in attaining their end, and after voyages lasting for thousands of years, were able to reach some neighbouring planetary system. The invaders were often in a desperate plight. Generally, they had used up most of the material of their little artificial sun. Economy had forced them to reduce their ration of heat and light so far that when at last they discovered a suitable planetary system, their native world was almost wholly Arctic. On arrival, they would first take up their position in a suitable orbit, and perhaps spend some centuries in recuperating. Then they would explore the neighbouring worlds, seek out the most hospitable, and begin to adapt themselves or their descendants to life upon it. If, as was often the case, any of the planets was already inhabited by intelligent beings, the invaders would inevitably come sooner or later into conflict with them, either in a crude manner over the right to exploit a planet's resources, or more probably over the invaders' obsession for propagating their own culture. For by now, the civilizing mission, which was the ostensible motive of all their heroic adventures, would have become a rigid obsession. They would be quite incapable of conceiving that the native civilization, though less developed than their own, might be more suited to the natives. Nor could they realize that their own culture, formerly the expression of a gloriously awakened world, might have sunk, in spite of their mechanical powers and crazy religious fervor, below the simpler culture of the natives in all the essentials of mental life. Many a desperate defense did we see, carried out by some world of the low rank of Homo sapiens, against a race of mad supermen, armed not only with the invincible power of subatomic energy, but with overwhelmingly superior intelligence, knowledge, and devotion, and moreover with the immense advantage that all its individuals participated in the unified mind of the race. Though we had come to cherish above all things the advancement of mentality, and were therefore prejudiced in favour of the awakened, though perverted, invaders, our sympathies soon became divided, and then passed almost wholly to the natives, however barbaric their culture. For in spite of their stupidity, their ignorance and superstition, their endless internecine conflicts, their spiritual obtuseness and grossness, we recognized in them a power which the others had forfeited, a naive but balanced wisdom, an animal shrewdness, a spiritual promise. The invaders, on the other hand, however brilliant, were indeed perverts. Little by little we came to regard the conflict as one in which an untamed but promising urchin had been set upon by an armed religious maniac. When the invaders had exploited every world in the new-found planetary system, they would again feel the lust of proselytization, persuading themselves that it was their duty to advance their religious empire throughout the galaxy. They would detach a couple of planets and dispatch them into space with a crew of pioneers. Or they would break up the whole planetary system and scatter it abroad with missionary zeal. Occasionally, their travel brought them into contact with another race of mad superiors. Then would follow a war in which one side or the other, or possibly both, would be exterminated. Sometimes the adventurers came upon worlds of their own rank, which had not succumbed to the mania of religious empire. Then the natives, though they would at first meet the invaders with courtesy and reason, would gradually realize that they were confronted with lunatics. They themselves would hastily convert their civilization for warfare. The issue would depend on superiority of weapons and military cunning. But if the contest was long and grim, the natives, even if victorious, might be so damaged mentally by an age of warfare that they would never recover their sanity. Worlds that suffered from the mania of religious imperialism would seek interstellar travel long before economic necessity forced it upon them. The saner world spirits, on the other hand, often discovered sooner or later a point beyond which increased material development and increased population were unnecessary for the exercise of their finer capacities. These were content to remain within their native planetary systems, in a state of economic and social stability. They were thus able to give most of their practical intelligence to telepathic exploration of the universe. Telepathic intercourse between worlds was now becoming much more precise and reliable. The galaxy had emerged from the primitive stage, when any world could remain solitary and live out its career in splendid isolation. In fact, just as in the experience of Homo sapiens, the Earth is now shrinking to the dimensions of a country, so in this critical period of the life of our galaxy, the whole galaxy was shrinking to the dimensions of a world. Those world spirits that had been most successful in telepathic exploration had by now constructed a fairly accurate mental map of the whole galaxy, though there still remained a number of eccentric worlds, with which no lasting contact could yet be made. There was also one very advanced system of worlds which had mysteriously faded out of telepathic intercourse altogether. Of this I shall tell more in the sequel. The telepathic ability of the mad worlds and systems was by now greatly reduced, though they were often under telepathic observation by the more mature world spirits, and were even influenced to some extent. They themselves were so self-complacent that they cared not to explore the mental life of the galaxy. Physical travel and sacred imperial power were for them good enough means of intercourse with the surrounding universe. In time there grew up several great rival empires of the mad worlds, each claiming to be charged with some sort of divine mission for the unifying and awakening of the whole galaxy. Between the ideologies of these empires there was little to choose, yet each was opposed to the others with religious fervour. Germinating in regions far apart, these empires easily mastered any sub-utopian worlds that lay within reach. Thus they spread from one planetary system to another, till at last empire made contact with empire. Then followed wars such as had never before occurred in our galaxy. Fleets of worlds, natural and artificial, manoeuvred among the stars to outwit one another, and destroyed one another with long-range jets of subatomic energy. As the tides of battle swept hither and thither through space, whole planetary systems were annihilated. Many a world spirit found a sudden end. Many a lowly race that had no part in the strife was slaughtered in the celestial warfare that raged around it. Yet so vast is the galaxy that these intermundane wars, terrible as they were, could at first be regarded as rare accidents, mere unfortunate episodes in the triumphant march of civilization. But the disease spread. More and more of the sane worlds, when they were attacked by the mad empires, reorganized themselves for military defense. They were right in believing that the situation was one with which non-violence alone could not cope. For the enemy, unlike any possible group of human beings, was too thoroughly purged of humanity to be susceptible to sympathy. But they were wrong in hoping that arms could save them, even though in the ensuing war the defenders might gain victory in the end. The struggle was generally so long and devastating that the victors themselves were irreparably damaged in spirit. In a later and perhaps the most terrible phase of our galaxy's life, I was forcibly reminded of the state of bewilderment and anxiety that I had left behind me on the Earth. Little by little, the whole galaxy, some 90,000 light-years across, containing more than 30,000 million stars, and by this date, over 100,000 planetary systems, and actually thousands of intelligent races, was paralyzed by the fear of war, and periodically tortured by its outbreak. In one respect, however, the state of the galaxy was much more desperate than the state of our little world today. None of our nations is an awakened super-individual. Even those peoples which are suffering from the mania of herd glory are composed of individuals who in their private life are sane. A change of fortune might perhaps drive such a people into a less crazy mood, or skillful propaganda for the idea of human unity might turn the scale. But in this grim age of the galaxy, the mad worlds were mad almost down to the very roots of their being. Each was a super-individual whose whole physical and mental constitution, including the unit bodies and minds of its private members, was by now organized through and through for a mad purpose. There seemed to be no more possibility of appealing to the stunted creatures to rebel against the sacred and crazy purpose of their race than of persuading the individual brain cells of a maniac to make a stand for gentleness. To be alive in those days, in one of the worlds that were sane and awakened, though not of the very highest, most percipient order, was to feel, or will be to feel, that the plight of the galaxy was desperate. These average sane worlds had organized themselves into a league to resist aggression. But since they were far less developed in military organization than the mad worlds, and much less inclined to subject their individual members to military despotism, they were at a great disadvantage. Moreover, the enemy was now united, for one empire had secured complete mastery over the others, and had inspired all the mad worlds with an identical passion of religious imperialism. Though the united empires of the mad worlds included only a minority of the worlds of the galaxy, the sane worlds had no hope of a speedy victory, for they were disunited and unskilled in warfare. Meanwhile, war was undermining the mental life of the League's own members. The urgencies and horrors were beginning to blot out from their minds all the more delicate, more developed capacities. They were becoming less and less capable of those activities of personal intercourse and cultural adventure which they still forlornly recognized as the true way of life. The great majority of the worlds of the League, finding themselves caught in a trap from which seemingly there was no escape, came despairingly to feel that the spirit which they had thought divine, the spirit which seeks true community and true awakening, was after all not destined to triumph, and therefore not the essential spirit of the cosmos. Blind chance, it was rumored, ruled all things, or perhaps a diabolic intelligence. Some began to conceive that the Star Maker had created merely for the lust of destroying. Undermined by this terrible surmise, they themselves sank far towards madness. With horror, they imagined that the enemy was indeed, as he claimed, the instrument of divine wrath, punishing them for their own impious will to turn the whole galaxy, the whole cosmos, into a paradise of generous and fully awakened beings. Under the influence of this growing sense of ultimate satanic power, and the even more devastating doubt of the rightness of their own ideals, the League members despaired. Some surrendered to the enemy, others succumbed to internal discord, losing their mental unity. The War of the Worlds seemed likely to end in the victory of the insane. And so indeed it would have done, but for the interference of that remote and brilliant system of worlds, which, as was mentioned above, had for a long while withdrawn itself from telepathic intercourse with the rest of our galaxy. This was the system of worlds which had been founded in the springtime of the galaxy by the symbiotic ichthyoids and arachnoids. 3. A crisis in galactic history. Throughout this period of imperial expansion, a few world systems of a very high order, though less awakened than the symbiotics of the sub-galaxy, had watched events telepathically from afar. They saw the frontiers of empire advancing steadily towards them, and knew that they themselves would soon be implicated. They had the knowledge and power to defeat the enemy in war. They received desperate appeals for help, yet they did nothing. These were worlds that were organized through and through for peace and the activities proper to an awakened world. They knew that if they chose to remake their whole social structure and reorientate their minds, they could ensure military victory. They knew also that they would thereby save many worlds from conquest, from oppression, and from the possible destruction of all that was best in them. But they knew also that in reorganizing themselves for desperate warfare, in neglecting for a whole age of struggle all those activities which were proper to them, they would destroy the best in themselves more surely than the enemy would destroy it by oppression. And that in destroying this, they would be murdering what they believed to be the most vital germ in the galaxy. They therefore forswore military action. When at last one of these more developed world systems was itself confronted by mad religious enthusiasts, the natives welcomed the invaders, readjusted all their planetary orbits to accommodate the incoming planets, pressed the foreign power actually to settle part of its population in such of their own planets as afforded suitable climatic conditions, and secretly, gradually, subjected the whole mad race throughout the combined solar system to a course of telepathic hypnotism so potent that its communal mind was completely disintegrated. The invaders became mere uncoordinated individuals, such as we know on Earth. Henceforth, they were bewildered, short-sighted, torn by conflicts, ruled by no supreme purpose, obsessed more by self than by community. It had been hoped that when the mad communal mind had been abolished, the individuals of the invading race would soon be induced to open their eyes and their hearts to a nobler ideal. Unfortunately, the telepathic skill of the superior race was not sufficient to delve down to the long-buried chrysalis of the spirit in these beings, to give it air and warmth and light. Since the individual nature of these forlorn individuals was itself the product of a crazy world, they proved incapable of salvation, incapable of sane community. They were therefore segregated to work out their own unlovely destiny in ages of tribal quarrels and cultural decline, ending in the extinction which inevitably overtakes creatures that are incapable of adaptation to new circumstances. When several invading expeditions had been thus circumvented, there arose among the worlds of the mad United Empires a tradition that certain seemingly pacific worlds were in fact more dangerous than all other enemies, since plainly they had a strange power of poisoning the soul. The imperialists determined to annihilate these terrible opponents. The attacking forces were instructed to avoid all telepathic parley and blow the enemy to pieces at long range. This, it was found, could be most conveniently performed by exploding the sun of the doomed system. Stimulated by a potent ray, the atoms of the photosphere would start disintegrating, and the spreading fury would soon fling the star into the nova state, roasting all his planets. It was our lot to witness the extraordinary calm, nay, the exultation and joy with which these worlds accepted the prospect of annihilation, rather than debase themselves by resistance. Later, we were to watch the strange events which saved this galaxy of ours from disaster. But first came tragedy. From our observation points in the minds of the attackers and the attacked, we observed not once but three times the slaughter of races nobler than any that we had yet encountered, by perverts whose own natural mental rank was almost as high. Three worlds, or rather systems of worlds, each possessed by a diversity of specialized races, we saw annihilated. From these doomed planets, we actually observed the sun break out with tumultuous eruption, swelling hourly. We actually felt, through the bodies of our hosts, the rapidly increasing heat, and through their eyes the blinding light. We saw the vegetation wither, the seas begin to steam. We felt and heard the furious hurricanes which wrecked every structure and bowled the ruins before them. With awe and wonder, we experienced something of that exultation and inner peace with which the doomed angelic populations met their end. Indeed, it was this experienced angelic exultation in the hour of tragedy that gave us our first clear insight into the most spiritual attitude to fate. The sheer bodily agony of the disaster soon became intolerable to us, so that we were forced to withdraw ourselves from those martyred worlds. But we left the doomed populations themselves, accepting not only this torture, but the annihilation of their glorious community, with all its infinite hopes, accepting this bitterness, as though it were not lethal, but the elixir of immortality. Not till almost the close of our own adventure did we grasp for a moment the full meaning of this ecstasy. It was strange to us that none of these three victims made any attempt to resist the attack. Indeed, not one inhabitant in any of these worlds considered for a moment the possibility of resistance. In every case, the attitude to disaster seemed to express itself in such terms as these. To retaliate would be to wound our communal spirit beyond cure. We choose rather to die. The theme of spirit that we have created must inevitably be broken short, whether by the ruthlessness of the invader or by our own resort to arms. It is better to be destroyed than to triumph in slaying the spirit. Such as it is, the spirit that we have achieved is fair, and it is indestructibly woven into the tissue of the cosmos. We die praising the universe, in which at least such an achievement as ours can be. We die knowing that the promise of further glory outlives us in other galaxies. We die praising the Star Maker, the Star Destroyer. 4. Triumph in a Sub-Galaxy. It was after the destruction of the third system of worlds, when a fourth was preparing for its end, that a miracle, or a seeming miracle, changed the whole course of events in our galaxy. Before telling of this turn of fortune, I must double back the thread of my story and trace the history of the system of worlds, which was now to play the leading part in galactic events. It will be remembered that in an outlying island off the galactic continent, there lived the strange symbiotic race of ichthyoids and arachnoids. These beings supported almost the oldest civilization in the galaxy. They had reached the human plane of mental development even before the other men, and in spite of many vicissitudes during the thousands of millions of years of their career, they had made great progress. I referred to them last as having occupied all the planets of their system with specialized races of arachnoids, all of which were in permanent telepathic union with the ichthyoid population in the oceans of the home planet. As the ages passed, they were several times reduced almost to annihilation. Now by two daring physical experiments, now through two ambitious telepathic exploration. But in time they won through to a mental development unequalled in our galaxy. Their little island universe, their outlying cluster of stars, had come wholly under their control. It contained many natural planetary systems. Several of these included worlds which, when the early arachnoid explorers visited them telepathically, were found to be inhabited by native races of pre-utopian rank. These were left to work out their own destiny, save that in certain crises of their history, the symbiotics secretly brought to bear on them from afar a telepathic influence that might help them to meet their difficulties with increased vigor. Thus, when one of these worlds reached the crisis in which Homo sapiens now stands, it passed with seemingly natural ease straight on to the phase of world unity and the building of utopia. Great care was taken by the symbiotic race to keep its existence hidden from the primitives, lest they should lose their independence of mind. Thus, even while the symbiotics were voyaging among these worlds in rocket vessels and using the mineral resources of neighboring uninhabited planets, the intelligent worlds of pre-utopian rank were left unvisited. Not till these worlds had themselves entered the full utopian phase and were exploring their neighbor planets were they allowed to discover the truth. By then they were ready to receive it with exultation rather than disheartenment and fear. Thenceforth, by physical and telepathic intercourse, the young utopia would be speedily brought up to the spiritual rank of the symbiotics themselves and would cooperate on an equal footing in a symbiosis of worlds. Some of these pre-utopian worlds, not malignant but incapable of further advance, were left in peace and preserved, as we preserve wild animals in national parks for scientific interest. Eon after eon, these beings, tethered by their own futility, struggled in vain to cope with the crisis which modern Europe knows so well. In cycle after cycle, civilization would emerge from barbarism. Mechanization would bring the peoples into uneasy contact. National wars and class wars would breed the longing for a better world order, but breed it in vain. disaster after disaster, would undermine the fabric of civilization. Gradually, barbarism would return. Eon after eon, the process would repeat itself, under the calm telepathic observation of the symbiotics, whose existence was never suspected by the primitive creatures under their gaze. So might we ourselves look down into some rock pool, where lowly creatures repeat with naive zest dramas learned by their ancestors eons ago. The symbiotics could well afford to leave these museum pieces intact, for they had at their disposal scores of planetary systems. Moreover, armed with their highly developed physical sciences and with subatomic power, they were able to construct, out in space, artificial planets for permanent habitation. These great hollow globes of artificial supermetals and artificial transparent adamant ranged in size from the earliest and smallest structures, which were no bigger than a very small asteroid, to spheres considerably larger than the Earth. They were without external atmosphere, since their mass was generally too slight to prevent the escape of gases. A blanket of repelling force protected them from meteors and cosmic rays. The planet's external surface, which was wholly transparent, encased the atmosphere. Immediately beneath it hung the photosynthesis stations and the machinery for generating power from solar radiation. Part of this outer shell was occupied by astronomical observatories, machinery for controlling the planet's orbit, and great docks for interplanetary liners. The interior of these worlds was a system of concentric spheres supported by girders and gigantic arches. Interspersed between these spheres lay the machinery for atmospheric regulation, the great water reservoirs, the food factories and commodity factories, the engineering shops, the refuse conversion tracts, residential and recreational areas, and a wealth of research laboratories, libraries, and cultural centers. Since the symbiotic race was in origin marine, there was a central ocean where the profoundly modified, the physically indolent, and mentally athletic descendants of the original ichthyoids constituted the highest brain tract of the intelligent world. There, as in the primeval ocean of the home planet, the symbiotic partners sought one another, and the young of both species were nurtured. Such races of the subgalaxy, as were not in origin marine, constructed, of course, artificial planets, which, though of the same general type, were adapted to their special nature. But all the races found it also necessary to mould their own nature drastically to suit their new conditions. As the eons advanced, hundreds of thousands of worldlets were constructed, all of this type, but gradually increasing in size and complexity. Many a star without natural planets came to be surrounded by concentric rings of artificial worlds. In some cases, the inner rings contained scores, the outer rings thousands of globes adapted to life at some particular distance from the sun. Great diversity, both physical and mental, would distinguish worlds even of the same ring. Sometimes a comparatively old world, or even a whole ring of worlds, would feel itself outstripped in mental excellence by younger worlds and races, whose structure, physical and biological, embodied increasing skill. Then either the superannuated world would simply continue its life in a sort of backwater of civilization, tolerated, loved, studied by the younger worlds, or it would choose to die and surrender the material of its planet for new ventures. One very small and rather uncommon kind of artificial world consisted almost wholly of water. It was like a titanic bowl of goldfish. Beneath its transparent shell, studded with rocket machinery and interplanetary docks, lay a spherical ocean crossed by structural girders and constantly impregnated with oxygen. A small solid core represented the sea bottom. The population of ichthyoids and the visiting population of arachnoids swarmed in this huge encrusted drop. Each ichthyoid would be visited in turn by perhaps a score of partners whose working life was spent on other worlds. The life of the ichthyoids was indeed a strange one, for they were at once imprisoned and free of all space. An ichthyoid never left his native ocean, but he had telepathic intercourse with the whole symbiotic race throughout the sub-galaxy. Moreover, the one form of practical activity which the ichthyoids performed was astronomy. Immediately beneath the planet's glassy crust hung observatories, where the swimming astronomers studied the constitution of the stars and the distribution of the galaxies. These goldfish bowl worlds turned out to be transitional. Shortly before the age of the mad empires, the symbiotics began to experiment for the production of a world which should consist of a single physical organism. After ages of experiment, they produced a goldfish bowl type of world, in which the whole ocean was meshed by a fixed network of ichthyoid individuals in direct neutral connection with one another. This worldwide, living, polyp-like tissue had permanent attachments to the machinery and observatories of the world. Thus, it constituted a truly organic world organism. And since the coherent ichthyoid population supported together a perfectly unified mentality, each of these worlds was indeed in the fullest sense a minded organism like a man. One essential link with the past was preserved. Arachnoids, specially adapted to the new symbiosis, would visit from their remote planets and swim along the submarine galleries for union with their anchored mates. More and more of the stars of the outlying cluster, or sub-galaxy, came to be girdled with rings of worlds, and an increasing number of these worlds were of the new organic type. Of the populations of the sub-galaxy, most were descendants of the original ichthyoids or arachnoids. But there were also many whose natural ancestors were humanesque, and not a few that had sprung from avians, insectoids, or plant men. Between the worlds, between the rings of worlds, and between the solar systems, there was constant intercourse, both telepathic and physical. Small rocket-propelled vessels plied regularly within each system of planets. Larger vessels, or high-speed worldlets, voyaged from system to system, explored the whole sub-galaxy, and even ventured across the ocean of emptiness into the main body of the galaxy, where thousands upon thousands of planetless stars awaited encirclement by rings of worlds. Strangely, the triumphant advance of material civilization and colonization now slowed down and actually came to a standstill. Physical intercourse between worlds of the sub-galaxy was maintained, but not increased. Physical exploration of the neighboring fringe of the galactic continent was abandoned. Within the sub-galaxy itself, no new worlds were founded. Industrial activities continued, but at reduced pressure, and no further advance was made in the standard of material convenience. Indeed, manners and customs began to grow less dependent on mechanical aids. Among the symbiotic worlds, the arachnoid populations were reduced in number. The ichthyoids in their cells of ocean lived in a permanent state of mental concentration and fervor, which, of course, was telepathically shared by their partners. It was at this time that telepathic intercourse between the advanced sub-galaxy and the few awakened worlds of the continent was entirely abolished. During recent ages, communication had been very fragmentary. The sub-galactics had apparently so far outstripped their neighbors that their interest in those primitives had become purely archaeological, and was gradually eclipsed by the enthralling life of their own community of worlds and by their telepathic exploration of remote galaxies. To us, the band of explorers, desperately struggling to maintain contact between our communal mind and the incomparably more developed minds of these worlds, the finest activities of the sub-galactics were at present inaccessible. We observed only a stagnation of the more obvious physical and mental activities of these systems of worlds. It seemed at first that this stagnation must be caused by some obscure flaw in their nature. Was it, perhaps, the first stage of irrevocable decline? Later, however, we began to discover that this seeming stagnation was a symptom not of death, but of more vigorous life. Attention had been drawn from material advancement just because it had opened up new spheres of mental discovery and growth. In fact, the great community of worlds, whose members consisted of some thousands of world spirits, was busy digesting the fruits of its prolonged phase of physical progress, and was now finding itself capable of new and unexpected psychical activities. At first, the nature of these activities was entirely hidden from us. But in time, we learned how to let ourselves be gathered up by these superhuman beings so as to obtain at least an obscure glimpse of the matters which so enthralled them. They were concerned, it seemed, partly with telepathic exploration of the great host of 10 million galaxies, partly with a technique of spiritual discipline by which they strove to come to more penetrating insight into the nature of the cosmos and to a finer creativity. This, we learned, was possible because their perfect community of worlds was tentatively waking into a higher plane of being, as a single communal mind whose body was the whole sub-galaxy of worlds. Though we could not participate in the life of this lofty being, we guessed that its absorbing passion was not wholly unlike the longing of the noblest of our own human species to come face to face with God. This new being desired to have the percipience and the hardihood to endure direct vision of the source of all light and life and love. In fact, this whole population of worlds was wrapped in a prolonged and mystical adventure. 5. The Tragedy of the Perverts. Such was the state of affairs when, in the main galactic continent, the mad United Empires concentrated their power upon the few worlds that were not merely sane, but of superior mental rank. The attention of the symbiotics and their colleagues in the supremely civilized sub-galaxy had long been withdrawn from the petty affairs of the continent. It was given instead to the cosmos as a whole, and to the inner discipline of the spirit. But the first of the three murders perpetrated by the United Empires upon a population far more developed than themselves seems to have caused a penetrating reverberation to echo, so to speak, through all the loftier spheres of existence. Even in the full flight of their career, the subgalactics took cognizance. Once more, attention was directed telepathically to the neighboring continent of stars. While the situation was being studied, the second murder was committed. The subgalactics knew that they had power to prevent any further disaster. Yet to our surprise, our horror and incomprehension, they calmly awaited the third murder. Still more strange, the doomed worlds themselves, though in telepathic communication with the subgalaxy, made no appeal for help. Victims and spectators alike studied the situation with quiet interest, even with a sort of bright exultation, not wholly unlike amusement. From our lowlier plane, this detachment, this seeming levity, at first appeared less angelic than inhuman. Here was a whole world of sensitive and intelligent beings, in the full tide of eager life and communal activity. Here were lovers newly come together, scientists in the midst of profound research, artists intent on new delicacies of apprehension, workers in 1,000 practical social undertakings of which man has no conception. Here, in fact, was all the rich diversity of personal lives that go to make up a highly developed world in action. And each of these individual minds participated in the communal mind of all, each experienced not only as a private individual, but as the very spirit of his race. Yet these calm beings faced the destruction of their world with no more distress seemingly than one of us would feel at the prospect of resigning his part in some interesting game. And in the minds of the spectators of this impending tragedy, we observed no agony of compassion, but only such commiseration tinged with humour, as we might feel for some distinguished tennis player who was knocked out in the first round of a tournament by some trivial accident, such as a sprained ankle. With difficulty, we came to understand the source of this strange equanimity. Spectators and victims alike were so absorbed in cosmological research, so conscious of the richness and potentiality of the cosmos, and above all, so possessed by spiritual contemplation, that the destruction was seen, even by the victims themselves, from the point of view which men would call divine. Their gay exultation and their seeming frivolity were rooted in the fact that to them the personal life, and even the life and death of individual worlds, appeared chiefly as vital themes contributing to the life of the cosmos. From the cosmical point of view, the disaster was, after all, a very small, though poignant, matter. Moreover, if by the sacrifice of another group of worlds, even of splendidly awakened worlds, greater insight could be attained into the insanity of the mad empires, the sacrifice was well worthwhile. So the third murder was committed. Then came the miracle. The telepathic skill of the sub-galaxy was far more developed than that of the scattered superior worlds on the galactic continent. It could dispense with the aid of normal intercourse, and it could overcome every resistance. It could reach right down to the buried chrysalis of the spirit, even in the most perverted individual. This was not a merely destructive power, blotting out the communal mind hypnotically. It was a kindling, an awakening power, brought to bear on the sane but dormant core of each individual. This skill was now exercised upon the galactic continent with triumphant but also tragic effect, for even this skill was not omnipotent. There appeared here and there among the mad worlds a strange and spreading disease of the mind. To the orthodox imperialists in those worlds themselves, it seemed a madness. But it was in fact a late and ineffectual waking into sanity on the part of beings whose nature had been moulded through and through for madness in a mad environment. The course of this disease of sanity in a mad world ran generally as follows. Individuals, here and there, while still playing their part in the well-disciplined action and communal thought of the world, would find themselves teased by private doubts and disgusts opposed to the dearest assumptions of the world in which they lived. Doubts of the worth of record-breaking travel and record-breaking empire, and disgust with the cult of mechanical triumph and intellectual servility and the divinity of the race. As these disturbing thoughts increased, the bewildered individuals would begin to fear for their own sanity. Presently, they would cautiously sound their neighbors. Little by little, doubt would become more widespread and more vocal, until at last considerable minorities in each world, though still playing their official part, would lose contact with the communal mind and become mere isolated individuals, but individuals at heart more sane than the lofty communal mind from which they had fallen. The orthodox majority, horrified at this mental disintegration, would then apply the familiar ruthless methods that had been used so successfully in the uncivilized outposts of empire. The dissentients would be arrested, and either destroyed outright or concentrated upon the most inhospitable planet, in the hope that their torture might prove an effective warning to others. This policy failed. The strange mental disease spread more and more rapidly, till the lunatics outnumbered the sane. There followed civil wars, mass martyrdom of devoted pacifists, dissension among the imperialists, a steady increase of lunacy in every world of the empire. The whole imperial organization fell to pieces, and since the aristocratic worlds that formed the backbone of empire were as impotent as soldier ants to maintain themselves without the service and tribute of the subject worlds, the loss of empire doomed them to death. When almost the whole population of such a world had gone sane, great efforts would be made to reorganize its life for self-sufficiency and peace. It might have been expected that this task, though difficult, would not have defeated a population of beings whose sheer intelligence and social loyalty were incomparably greater than anything known on Earth. But there were unexpected difficulties, not economic but psychological. These beings had been fashioned for war, tyranny, and empire. Though telepathic stimulation from superior minds could touch into life the slumbering germ of the spirit in them and help them to realize the triviality of their world's whole purpose, telepathic influence could not refashion their nature to such an extent that they could henceforth actually live for the spirit and renounce the old life. in spite of heroic self-discipline. They tended to sink into inertia, like wild beasts domesticated, or to run amok and exercise against one another those impulses of domination which hitherto had been directed upon subject worlds. And all this they did with profound consciousness of guilt. For us it was heartrending to watch the agony of these worlds. Never did the newly enlightened beings lose their vision of true community and of the spiritual life. But though the vision haunted them, the power to realize it in the detail of action was lost. Moreover, there were times when the change of heart that they had suffered seemed to them actually a change for the worse. Formerly, all individuals had been perfectly disciplined to the common will, and perfectly happy in executing that will without the heart searchings of individual responsibility. But now, individuals were mere individuals, and all were tormented by mutual suspicion and by violent propensities for self-seeking. The issue of this appalling struggle in the minds of these former imperialists depended on the extent to which specialization for empire had affected them. In a few young worlds in which specialization had not gone deep, a period of chaos was followed by a period of reorientation and world planning, and in due season, by sane utopia. But in most of these worlds, no such escape was possible. Either chaos persisted till racial decline set in, and the world sank to the human, the subhuman, the merely animal states, or else, in a few cases only, the discrepancy between the ideal and the actual was so distressing that the whole race committed suicide. We could not long endure the spectacle of scores of worlds falling into psychological ruin. Yet the subgalactics who had caused these strange events, and continued to use their power to clarify and so destroy these minds, watched their handiwork unflinchingly. Pity they felt, pity such as we feel for a child that has broken its toy, but no indignation against fate. Within a few thousand years, every one of the imperial worlds had either transformed itself, or fallen into barbarism, or committed suicide. 6. A Galactic Utopia. The events that I have been describing took place, or from the human point of view will take place, at a date as far future to us as we are from the condensation of the earliest stars. The next period of galactic history covers the period from the fall of the Mad Empires to the achievement of utopia in the whole galactic community of worlds. This transitional period was in itself in a manner utopian, for it was an age of triumphant progress carried out by beings whose nature was rich and harmonious, whose nurture was entirely favourable, and their ever-widening galactic community a wholly satisfying object of loyalty. It was only not utopian, in the sense that the galactic society was still expanding and constantly changing its structure to meet new needs, economic and spiritual. At the close of this phase, there came a period of full utopia, in which the attention of the perfected galactic community was directed mainly beyond itself towards other galaxies. Of this I shall tell in due course, and of the unforeseen and stormy events which shattered this beatitude. Meanwhile, we must glance at the age of expansion. The worlds of the subgalaxy, recognizing that no further great advance in culture was possible, unless the population of awakened worlds was immensely increased and diversified, now began to plan an active part in the work of reorganizing the whole galactic continent. By telepathic communication, they gave to all awakened worlds throughout the galaxy knowledge of the triumphant society which they themselves had created, and they called upon all to join them in the founding of the galactic utopia. Every world throughout the galaxy, they said, must be an intensely conscious individual, and each must contribute its personal idiosyncrasy and all the wealth of its experience to the pooled experience of all. When at last the community was completed, they said, it must go on to fulfill its function in the far greater community of all galaxies, there to participate in spiritual activities as yet but dimly guessed. In their earlier age of meditation, the subgalactic worlds, or rather the single intermittently awakening mind of the subgalaxy, had evidently made discoveries which had very precise bearing on the founding of the Galactic Society. For they now put forward the demand that the number of minded worlds in the galaxy must be increased to at least 10,000 times its present extent. In order that all the potentialities of the spirit should be fulfilled, they said there must be a far greater diversity of world types, and thousands of worlds of each type. They themselves, in their small subgalactic community, had learned enough to realize that only a very much greater community could explore all the regions of being, some few of which they themselves had glimpsed, but only from afar. The natural worlds of the galactic continent were bewildered and alarmed by the magnitude of this scheme. They were content with the extant scale of life. The spirit, they affirmed, had no concern for magnitude and multiplicity. To this, the reply was made that such a protest came ill from worlds whose own achievement depended on the splendid diversity of their members. Diversity and multiplicity of worlds was as necessary on the galactic plane as diversity and multiplicity of individuals on the world plane, and diversity and multiplicity of nerve cells on the individual plane. In the upshot, the natural worlds of the continent played a decreasing part in the advancing life of the galaxy. Some merely remained at the level of their own unaided achievement. Some joined in the great cooperative work, but without fervour and without genius. A few joined heartily and usefully in the enterprise. One indeed was able to contribute greatly. This was a symbiotic race, but of a very different kind from that which had founded the community of the subgalaxy. The symbiosis consisted of two races which had originally inhabited separate planets of the same system. An intelligent avian species, driven to desperation by the desiccation of its native planet, had contrived to invade a neighbouring world inhabited by a man-like species. Here I must not tell how, after ages of alternating strife and cooperation, a thorough economic and psychological symbiosis was established. The building of the galactic community of worlds lies far beyond the comprehension of the writer of this book. I cannot now remember at all clearly what I experienced of these obscure matters in the state of heightened lucidity which came to me through participation in the communal mind of the explorers. And even in that state, I was bewildered by the effort to comprehend the aims of that close-knit community of worlds. If my memory is to be trusted at all, three kinds of activity occupied the minded worlds in this phase of galactic history. The main practical work was to enrich and harmonize the life of the galaxy itself, to increase the number and diversity and mental unity of the fully awakened worlds up to the point which it was believed was demanded for the emergence of a mode of experience more awakened than any hitherto attained. The second kind of activity was that which sought to make closer contact with the other galaxies by physical and telepathic study. The third was the spiritual exercise appropriate to beings of the rank of the world minds. This last seems to have been concerned, or will be concerned, at once with the deepening of the self-awareness of each individual world spirit and the detachment of its will from merely private fulfillment. But this was not all, for on this relatively high level of the spirit's ascent, as on our own lowliest of all spiritual planes, there had also to be a more radical detachment from the whole adventure of life and mind in the cosmos. For as the spirit wakens, it craves more and more to regard all existence not merely with a creature's eyes, but in the universal view, as though through the eyes of the Creator. At first, the task of establishing the galactic utopia occupied almost the whole energy of the awakened worlds. More and more of the stars were encircled with concentric hoops of pearls, perfect though artificial. And each pearl was a unique world occupied by a unique race. Henceforth, the highest level of persistent individuality was not a world, but a system of scores or hundreds of worlds. And between the systems, there was as easy and delightful converse as between human individuals. In these conditions, to be a conscious individual was to enjoy immediately the united sensory impressions of all the races inhabiting a system of worlds. And as the sense organs of the worlds apprehended not only nakedly, but also through artificial instruments of great range and subtlety, the conscious individual perceived not only the structure of hundreds of planets, but also the configuration of the whole system of planets clustered about its sun. Other systems also it perceived, as men perceive one another. For in the distance, the glittering bodies of other multi-mundane persons like itself gyrated and drifted. Between the minded planetary systems occurred infinite variations of personal intercourse. As between human individuals, there were loves and hates, temperamental sympathies and antipathies, joyful and distressful intimacies, cooperations and thwartings in personal ventures, and in the great common venture of building the galactic utopia. Between individual systems of worlds, as between symbiotic partners, there sometimes occurred relationships with an almost sexual flavour, though actual sex played no part in them. Neighbouring systems would project travelling worldlets, or greater worlds, or trains of worlds, across the ocean of space, to take up orbits round each other's suns, and play intimate parts in symbiotic, or rather sympsychic, relationships in one another's private life. Occasionally a whole system would migrate to another system and settle its worlds in rings between the rings of the other system. Telepathic intercourse united the whole galaxy, but telepathy, though it had the great advantage that it was not affected by distance, was seemingly imperfect in other ways. So far as possible, it was supplemented by physical travel. A constant stream of touring worldlets percolated through the whole galaxy in every direction. The task of establishing utopia in the galaxy was not pursued without friction. Different kinds of races were apt to have different policies for the galaxy. Though war was by now unthinkable, the sort of strife which we know between individuals or associations within the same state was common. There was, for instance, a constant struggle between the planetary systems that were chiefly interested in the building of utopia, those that were most concerned to make contact with other galaxies, and those whose main preoccupation was spiritual. Besides these great parties, there were groups of planetary systems which were prone to put the well-being of individual world systems above the advancement of galactic enterprise. They cared more for the drama of personal intercourse and the fulfillment of the personal capacity of worlds and systems than for organization or exploration or spiritual purification. Though their presence was often exasperating to the enthusiasts, it was salutary, for it was a guarantee against extravagance and against tyranny. It was during the age of the galactic utopia that another salutary influence began to take full effect on the busy worlds. Telepathic research had made contact with the long-extinct plant men, who had been undone by the extravagance of their own mystical quietism. The utopian world now learned much from these archaic but uniquely sensitive beings. Henceforth, the vegetal mode of experience was thoroughly, but not dangerously, knit into the texture of the galactic mind.